This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we learn how medical students are becoming bilingual to better serve their patients, plus how improving colorectal cancer screening saves lives. But first, the heroin problem we face in Central New York. The apparent heroin overdose death of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman comes amid a sharp rise in trafficking of the illegal narcotic across the U.S.-Mexico border in recent years, and a growing abuse of the drug nationwide. And right here in Central New York, we too have been experiencing a corresponding rise in its use. We'll hear with more on this our Michelle Kaliva. She's administrative director of the Upstate New York Poison Center, and Dr. Nicholas Naka. He is a clinical instructor in the Department of Emergency Medicine and a medical toxicology fellow at the Upstate New York Poison Center as well. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
So, Michelle, Central New York, we're having a similar problem with heroin. Tell us about that.
I'm just taking a quick survey of calls into Onondaga County over the last 5 years. We've gone from 14 calls in 2009 to 84 calls in 2013.
Wow.
We've also seen an increase in fatalities. Again, we didn't see a lot of fatalities around heroin back in 2009, 2010, and 2013 we had several deaths.
So really in the last 4 years, you've really been, 4 or 5 years, you've seen an exponential increase in heroin.
Significantly.
And before that, in your history, was there much heroin use?
You know, we would hear about heroin. We'd go out and we would teach a drug of abuse program to physicians and nurses, and they would, you know, everybody would say, yeah, heroin's still out there. Now when I do a program, I hear universally that heroin patients are coming through the emergency departments in great numbers.
Dr. Naka, why do you think this is happening?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with epidemic proportions of people who are addicted to prescription painkillers right now. It was, back in the 80s and early 90s, there was a big push for physicians in general to treat all pain, all of their patients' pain. And there was even some drug company misinformation out there that that maybe some of these prescription painkillers were not addictive. But in fact, they are opioids, which is just like an opiate, which is what heroin and morphine
are. Give me some examples, just for our listeners, of what those drugs are.
Sure. Well, we refer to them as hydrocodone and oxycodone, but the brand names you run across are Lortab, Vicodin, oxycodone, Oxycontin, many people are on them for chronic back pain, when in fact they're really not efficacious in the long term for chronic pain at all. And what we've ended up doing is creating a lot of people who have opioid addiction. And then eventually, as now we start to recognize this and we start to cut off some of the prescribing practices of these prescription pain medications, patients who have developed an addiction have to turn to an alternative like heroin, which is much cheaper and easier to get a hold of.
So this is, I guess, what the kind of where the rub is, that we've created, perhaps, in response to people's needs for a quick fix to get rid of their pain, we've created these basically opioid addicts. Mm-hmm. And also the whole other side is that kids, perhaps, have been able to get some of these drugs from their parents' medicine cabinets as well. So that's a whole other thing I want to get to. But right now, what ends up happening is people are addicted. The doctors, especially in New York State, has this new iStop program where they're monitoring very carefully these drugs. And so people turn to something like heroin. Well, what's the story with heroin? Why is it cheaper? Tell us about that, Michelle.
Well, we go back a year, too, when the synthetic drug problem was really rampant throughout our community. The folks that distribute heroin had to stay competitive, so they dropped their prices. So heroin now is fairly inexpensive on the streets. So it's accessible, and it's cheap.
Wow. So obviously, the dangers of both the oxycodone and the heroin is that it's addictive, and you need increasing amounts, I guess, to feel okay. Is that the idea? Are you actually getting high, or are you just at this point maintaining the habit?
Oh, there's definitely euphoria associated with it. I think that there's, you know, you got to be a little careful because there is a difference between dependence and addiction. So when you talk about requiring escalated doses, you're not so much talking about addiction as much as, you know, a need for the drug in order to maintain your normal state of activity, so to speak. You know, the drugs are definitely euphoric. They're definitely looking for a high. If you talk to addicts, they're always talking about their first high and trying to get back to that same feeling of euphoria.
Do they ever get back to it, though?
They don't, actually. It's kind of interesting because I think, you know, going back to starting with a prescription pain medication, a common story that I find when I interview my patients in the emergency department, and I do in depth because I'm interested in the matter. A lot of the young people, especially, they it's exactly like you said. Their parents had a prescription pain medication in the cabinet from a surgery. They found that, they used it once or twice and liked the feeling. They maybe just ate the tablet, you know, and then they realized that, well, if they crush it up and snort it, well, they get an even stronger effect of the drug. And then as that runs dry, then they find a source for the heroin. They may start by snorting the heroin and because that's not a needle, it's not as scary. But then eventually they find that if they inject it, it's an even stronger high. So it's kind of this progression going from a prescription pain medication that was left over from a surgery to a full-blown heroin addiction.
Wow. And are they able to sustain? I mean, is it the kind of thing where they become addicted quickly? I mean, is it the first time you use heroin, do you become addicted?
I think, you know, that's a hard thing to say. I think the first time you use heroin, you definitely want to experience that again.
It may not be actually a physiologic addiction as much as it might be a psychological addiction initially. Or I guess it's hard to tease out.
It's hard to tease out how quickly you develop a physiological addiction. Yeah.
But basically, the whole notion of besides the addictive problem, You've had a lot higher increase in fatal heroin overdoses. Why is that?
Well, you know, there's a real concern with heroin because it's a CNS depressant as well as a respiratory depressant. So folks, you know, seemingly are okay and they're asleep, but in reality, the respiratory rates drop down to 3 and, you know, and they die. And unfortunately, family members, friends think they're just resting. Leave them, don't get the necessary help, don't call 911. In fact, they show up, you know, DOA or dead on arrival.
I read somewhere that there was a 45% increase from 2006 to 2010, and you said there's actually a lot more than that.
Yeah, since then, I read recently there's a great article by Dr. Hoffman down in New York City in the New York Times in the past couple of weeks, and he cited something like 85% in the past couple of years, an increase in heroin-related deaths, and I think it all goes back to the start of the problem where we were trying to treat pain, and we got these prescription pain medications out there.
I also saw something that was very interesting to me in terms of why there was a rise in deaths. It had to do with more increase in the use of the drug, obviously, but there was an increased availability in what they said, high purity heroin. Tell me about that, Michelle.
So it's the heroin that's on the market. So it's a very concentrated, very strong, potent drug. And again, I don't know that the everyday user necessarily knows what they're getting.
And I saw that there seems to be a growing number of people using it at a younger age. Is that what you're seeing, Dr.
Yeah, absolutely. Clinically, I mean, I had a 14-year-old boy the other day who was experiencing his third or fourth overdose within a week of prescription pain medications, and he hadn't gotten to the heroin yet. But if projecting into the future, that's really the only place that
really
kind of addiction is going to go.
Really scary stuff. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Michelle Kaliva and Dr. Nicholas Naka from the Upstate New York Poison Center, and we're talking about the rise in heroin use right here in central New York. So, Michelle, also, not all of these street drugs are pure heroin. What is this new fentanyl-laced heroin? Tell us about that.
Pretty scary because, again, we're a lot of fatalities associated with that high degree of, again, respiratory depression, high degree of CNS depression.
So it's more powerful,
it's
more potent?
Right, a lot more side effects. And, again, I don't know that the user knows that or is anticipating that.
And so that's, again, potentially leads to taking
too
much
right,
and
taking
overdose.
Too much. Right, an overdose.
So what is the Poison Center doing about this?
You know, when we hear about these trends, the one thing that we're able to do is professional education. So we're out there, we're talking to emergency room physicians, nurses, EMS, we're getting the word out. But we've also expanded our education to include schools. So we've been out in schools, we've been talking to the teens. It's mostly high school. We've talked a little bit to middle school. Quite honestly, we got a lot of information from that population and hear from them how rampant it is. Parents groups as well, trying to alert everyone to...
And it's no longer just an inner city problem. Oh. What do you see?
Yeah, I think that's a false perception that this is an inner city thing. We see a lot of it, you know, in the smaller city of Syracuse and in the surrounding suburbs. And you know, I mean, that's the thing, right? You think that maybe this is a problem of homeless people on the street, and it's really not. It's our, you know, it's our straight A students in the suburbs that find their parents pain medication, get addicted, and then develop these problems. I had a really sad story of a 16-year-old I saw a couple years ago who had, I think she'd come in for an attempted suicide, and the reason she wanted to kill herself was because she got caught stealing a gun from her grandfather's case in order to pay off a heroin debt. And when she got caught, she didn't want to go to jail. She didn't want to, you know, go through the whole thing, so she tried to hurt herself.
Frightening.
It is.
Really frightening. So what preventative measures can we be taking, or should we be taking?
Yeah, so, well, there's a push in New York City where this is a, you know, it's still a problem for us, but a bigger problem for them, for getting an antidote out on the street. And the antidote is naloxone. And it's what we use in the emergency department if the patient arrives and we see that they've overdosed on an opioid. Problem being is that a lot of these patients don't even get to the emergency department. They die long before they get, you know, they could get, you know, EMS activated and get transported to the hospital. So down in New York City, there are programs trying to distribute this antidote out onto the street to friends and family of users, to users themselves, so that when they're using with friends, if there's an overdose, they can reverse it. And there's some bills before the New York State Senate to try to push that through. And there are some programs, like I said, in New York City trying to get that done. And I do want to address that there is a perception that maybe if we put out the antidote, maybe we're somehow facilitating the use of drugs.
Its use.
Mm-hmm. But again, in that article that I referred to earlier by Dr. Hoffman in the New York Times, he points out that that's like saying... that's like saying we shouldn't have seatbelts and airbags in cars because that promotes unsafe driving.
I think that's a very
perfect analogy.
Pointed point, absolutely. And Michelle, what are you seeing in terms of the response of kids when you go out to the schools? I mean, do you have a sense that they're taking it seriously, or is it just are you being blown off in a sense? What are you really thinking?
You know, they don't really believe that it's as dangerous as it is. They are not taking it seriously at all. They're saying that it's so commonplace that they're not heeding the warnings, unfortunately.
That's even more frightening.
It is.
Do you think that we should be doing more on a public service announcement kind of thing? Do you think we should be getting, it sounds like it's becoming so much more rampant and, as you said, cheaper, that it just seems like the danger just grows.
Onondaga County, actually, there's a great response among multiple agencies in Onondaga County around the opioid abuse, and heroin is just going to be the next step. So we're working with, the Poison Center's working with the Prevention Network and with Onondaga County Department of Health, and so there definitely are steps in place right now to get the message out. A lot of different programs.
So what do you say, Dr. Naka, is the takeaway for our listeners? If you're out there and you think you might, you know, you have perhaps teenage kids or even older kids or even someone in your life, an adult that you care about, and you have a suspicion or a concern, what's the takeaway? What do you recommend?
I think the takeaway is, number one, be aware that this is a big problem that really can affect everybody. You know, nobody's exempt from this problem. And so just being aware that this is an issue is huge. Number two is, if you have prescription pain medications from surgeries in your cabinet, get rid of them. If you're not using them anymore, bring them back to the pharmacy or dispose of them in another way, a safe way. If you have prescription pain medications that you're using, lock them up and know that this is an issue that transcends all of us.
And perhaps talk to your kids about heroin. I mean, that it's a very scary, dangerous thing. And perhaps, although tragic, this high-profile death of an overdose to this incredible actor, Philip Seymour Hoffman, will maybe raise awareness And you guys obviously are raising awareness as well. So I want to thank you so much for coming in. My guests have been Michelle Kaliva, Administrative Director of the Upstate New York Poison Center, and Dr. Nicholas Naka. He is a clinical instructor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Upstate Medical University and a medical toxicology fellow at the Upstate New York Poison Center. Next up, how medical students are becoming bilingual to better serve their patients. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, the success of medical care depends in large part on positive communication and trust between the patients and their healthcare providers. Well, here with more on an important component of this communication is Maria Lourdes Valles, medical Spanish instructor at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Maria. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, Linda.
So I understand that what you're doing here at Upstate is teaching medical students Spanish.
Yes.
Tell us about
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And this program started actually in 2006. It is an elective. The students earn 2 credits. And they take it because they really appreciate the opportunity to be able to develop the trust between patient and provider.
Yeah.
You have no idea how important it is for a Spanish-speaking patient at least to hear the doctor greet them in Spanish, ask them how they are feeling, and just the basic questions that you will have in an interview with the patient.
Yeah, it seems to me that so often, especially if someone comes from another country, mm-hmm. any country that speaks any dialect of Spanish, mm-hmm. they come with a certain amount of cultural trepidation, I mean fear, of the fact that they're in a new environment, they don't exactly know how the system works, they're going to be greeted by someone who's asking them somewhat personal questions. And if it's in their own language, I can only imagine that it cuts through a tremendous amount of barriers.
It is. It is a very, very difficult situation to be in. And as you know, you travel extensively, and we always fear to have an accident in a country where we cannot, when we cannot speak the language. And most of the people that seek medical care, they do know some Spanish, but they are not proficient in English. And that is why they need the services of an interpreter, or the best thing is from a doctor that can really approach them, greet them, and do the basic evaluation in their own language.
So were you involved in this program from the very beginning, from its inception?
Oh, yes, actually.
We started the program.
Thanks to 3 very determined students that they are practicing medicine now, and the support of Dr. Susan Stearns and George Blakesley. And interesting enough, this program was adopted or sponsored by the Department of Psychiatry.
Mm.
I have to tell you honestly, I have no idea how it works in the university like that. A new program has to be sponsored by a department. And at that time, apparently, the only one that was willing to do it, it was the Department of Psychiatry.
Well, it's wonderful that they did that, because, in fact, Department of you can see why psychiatry, looking out for the psychological well-being of patients, would understand the importance.
Absolutely. And I think that was exactly what happened. The dean of the Department of Psychiatry at the time, he fully understood the impact of this valuable program by helping the patients not only in the physical but the emotional aspect of their situation.
Besides your knowledge of Spanish, which clearly you're a Spanish, it's your mother tongue,
Absolutely,
Spanish.
Yes.
What else do you bring to this task? How can you approach this whole field of medical Spanish, for example?
Well, I always, even from high school, that's a long, long time ago, I always took anatomy courses, physiology. Then in college, if I have to take an elective, I also took anything related with medicine.
Why
is
that?
I have had a passion. Because my grandfather was a doctor, You can imagine in Ecuador at the time, he
lived. So you came from Ecuador?
Yes. I was born and raised in Quito, Ecuador. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate to come to the United States with a fabulous job representing the country of Ecuador to the United Nations.
Wow.
I was a very young diplomat, and because I know English with accent at all, and all, I was transferred to the permanent mission of Ecuador to the United Nations.
Wow. And when was that?
That was in the early 60s.
Wow.
Yes.
So have you been here ever since?
Absolutely. I have spent my whole adult life in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And how did you learn English? Because you would have an understanding now teaching these English students, yes, English-speaking students, Spanish. You went through the process yourself. How did you learn English?
It's very interesting, but in Ecuador, the government asks, actually it's compulsory that in high school you learn English. So my husband, when we went to visit Ecuador the very first time, that is about 42 years ago, he was so surprised that if you ask a policeman for directions, he will give you in English. Many people in the stores, they will greet you if they realize that he didn't speak Spanish, so they will greet him in English. It is amazing how many people really know basic English, at least.
So that's what's very interesting to me, though, is that we can do that in our schools, too, but somehow the kids don't necessarily come out with a fluency. But it sounds like you had some great success with that.
The problem, in my opinion, is that we have to start earlier. In my case, for instance, I started in kindergarten learning French. I learned French and Spanish parallel. If I learned the colors in Spanish, I learned the colors in French. So I had 6 years of French. And then I had to transition to English in the high school.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm here with Maria Lourdes Valles, and we're talking about the importance of new doctors learning medical Spanish and her role, really, as an instructor in that goal. So early is clearly important, but in this case, these are medical students. They're much further along in their lives. What do you find in terms of their ability to pick up the Spanish, and is it harder for some, I would think, than others? Tell us about that.
It is very interesting, and I wish when I learn English, they would have taught me actually specific sounds of certain letters that they are still, after all these years, they are hard for me. And especially the double E and things like that, I have to be very, very careful pronouncing the sounds. Otherwise, it comes out very funny. And the students actually learn the proper pronunciation of every letter of the alphabet.
You do that with them?
I do that with my medical students. They start in their first semester of the first year, MS1, with a basic Spanish. That is a very, very strong foundation course. And they learn, as I said, from the alphabet on, and they learn the parts of the body in Spanish, the organs, the systems, and they move on to make short dialogues and basic questions.
So your focus remains, even though you say you have a foundation in Spanish, the focus still remains on a communication of the doctor to the patient.
Absolutely.
So it's around the anatomy, it's around medical issues, what their needs might be, that kind of
exactly, thing. Exactly, exactly. And the doctors really put that is the patients, because they ask them just from the beginning, how are you feeling today? I have always mentioned to the students that if you say, how are you? They will say, fine, okay, good, whatever. But if you ask a patient, how are you feeling today? It opens up to a dialogue.
That's very, very interesting.
Yes.
Also very interesting that a lot of people that these young medical students later to be doctors would come across could come from a number of different cultures, even with Spanish as the mother tongue. Mm-hmm. I mean, as you said, you came from Ecuador. There are people coming from Spain. There are people coming from Puerto Rico, from Mexico, from mm-hmm. all over in this country. How do you, or do you attempt to introduce them to any cultural differences or even a general Hispanic cultural difference?
Yes, I do. I usually teach them like the standard word that even if a person from a different country will understand, but they may not choose as the first word when they express themselves. Just a typical example, for the word stomach, I give them 5 different names. Depends not only in the country, but mainly in your level of education. And I always keep in mind that my students help in the summer clinics for migrant workers. So I keep that in mind so they will learn specific words for pain from Mexico or Guatemala, where most of the agricultural workers in this area are.
You know, I have a son. I'm very interested in this very, very personally because I have a son who's a pediatrician currently training in Boston, and he is very interested in improving in his Spanish and is planning to go to your home country, to Ecuador, this spring to actually be in a medical immersion program, medical Spanish immersion program, for that purpose alone. So clearly it's becoming very, very important, I think, for healthcare providers these days in our country to be able to converse and gain the trust of people whose mother tongue is Spanish.
Absolutely. And what I have noticed with my students from the very beginning, they have very, very little appreciation for the culture. They had very little knowledge of the difference between Central America, Mexico, that's in North America, and South America. But they understand now that it's not only the way that we pronounce words, there are many other differences. And they learn about, besides the medical Spanish, they do learn a little bit of culture and many other issues.
Yeah, I would think that would play a very significant role. For example, the role of what women play in the matriarchy in a family, or versus how the men are viewed mm-hmm. in these various cultures, and how they would then interact with their patients would be very much informed on the basis of understanding those cultural mores.
It is very, very useful. And I have noticed that a lot of the students that they take the medical Spanish from this program or from me, they go now to learn a little more Spanish in mainly Central America, and in 1 or 2 weeks intensive program, and they volunteer at different clinics and hospitals. So they are already practicing what they learn here, and for me that is extremely, extremely rewarding.
How quickly do you see, or how slowly, rather, do you see these students master their skills? Does it take them several years? I mean, what are you seeing in your experience?
It depends. It depends in their personal interest, in their ability. I have a good number of students that after the third semester, they are speaking all in Spanish.
Wow.
And I take them
you must
in the
be
basic.
A very good teacher.
I don't think so. I really think they appreciate the value. And they do. Like, for instance, in this year, I have 15 students this semester in the intermediate level. And we do everything in Spanish. They learn a specific vocabulary for specific illnesses, the questions, the relevant questions they should ask during an interview. And they feel very empowered because I really believe that knowledge is power.
I do,
and
too.
And I tell people that they may lose a business, they may lose a job, and knowledge is always theirs to keep.
That's true. And being bilingual in this world, multilingual as you are, is an incredible strength. Is this program now just for the medical students, or are you expanding to nurses or other healthcare professionals, or is that part of the thinking?
It is actually open to everybody.
I want to thank you so much for coming in. This has been so informative, and it's wonderful work that you're doing. So
well,
I congratulate you on this. My guest has been Maria Lourdes-Valles, and she's an adjunct instructor in medical Spanish at Upstate Medical University. Thanks so much for sharing your experiences with us.
It's a pleasure.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now for some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. Telling us what to do if we've knocked a tooth out is Dr. Patrick Smith, assistant professor and residency program director for the dental service at Upstate.
This is a fairly common occurrence that we actually see in our office. Here at Upstate, at times people do come into the emergency room for these types of issues. And of course, dental service is high on the priority of consultants that come in to look at the patient and treat them. When this is a situation that you're approached with, either a friend, a child, a family member in your house, you're out in this time of the year, we have sledding accidents, we have ice skating accidents, and falls are the most common reason that people may fracture a tooth or lose a tooth. So in those situations, it's probably the most important message that you want to understand is time is of the essence. When you actually lose a tooth, you have a very limited time frame in which to treat that situation. So from our standpoint, if this happens in a gymnasium, a sports complex, in the summertime, it may happen at the baseball field, at school. A lot of those institutions have what's called a save-a-tooth kit. And then what it is basically a liquid that preserves the tooth for a short period of time. And the most important thing is that the tissue is alive, and we need to maintain it until we can reimplant it into the socket from which it came. So when a patient either goes to the emergency room or goes and makes an urgent appointment at their dentist's office, the idea is, again, the tooth needs to be reimplanted into the socket as soon as possible. In our time frame, we like 30 to 60 minutes. Sooner is always better. If you feel comfortable looking at the tooth and handling the tooth, my message is always make sure you handle the tooth by the part you can see, meaning the crown, the top of the tooth. Never handle a tooth by the root. And in those cases, you want to make sure, again, that you put it in something moist. Milk is fine. If nothing else, water. Or if you feel comfortable, you can place it in the pouch of your cheek. Again, you need to maintain moisture at all times until you can seek professional help. Once you're at the dentist's office or an oral surgeon's office or the emergency room, those folks are going to help take it to the next step, which is numbing up the patient, getting them comfortable, and then trying to reimplant the tooth and secure it, almost like with braces at that time. There'll be follow-up needs, of course. You're going to have follow-up for a few months, actually, for something like that. So there are other things, but we want to get the tooth stabilized. We want to get back into its natural environment. And the best way to really do that is to reimplant the tooth as soon as possible. Now, if there are other associated injuries, sometimes you need to have the EMTs there, and the ambulance may come to help out with that. And you let them do what they need to, and oftentimes they, too, will help reimplant the teeth. So I think overall the issue, the take-home that we want to make sure is that people understand is it's alive. Even though it's not part of your body anymore, it's alive, and you need to get it taken care of. So placing it in a favorable environment, like we talked about, is the best way to initiate treatment.
Coming up next, how improving colorectal cancer screening is saving lives. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Simone Seward, an instructor in public health and preventive medicine at Upstate, with the Healthy Monday Minute for February 24th. Have a supermarket strategy. A good mood or hunger pangs can make a big difference in what you bring home from the grocery store. Both feelings tend to lead to a pile of unnecessary junk and other impulse buys. And once these items are in your home, you may feel obligated to eat them. Have a plan of attack this week. Write a grocery list and stick with it. Even include a few healthful snacks so you don't feel deprived. Still tempted to stray? Stick to the perimeters of the supermarket where you'll find most Whole Foods, or bypass the junk entirely with a trip to the farmer's market. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, colorectal cancer is the third most commonly diagnosed cancer and the second leading cause of cancer death in men and women combined in the United States. The American Cancer Society estimates that almost 143,000 people will be diagnosed with it, and that over 50,000 will die from colon cancer in the United States in this year alone. And early detection can make the difference between life and death. We'll hear with more on this and a new initiative to save lives through early detection is Dr. Christopher Morley, Associate Professor of Family Medicine, Public Health, and Psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Morley. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
So colorectal cancer is still a big killer each year.
It sure is. I think you highlighted some important stats there, and it's still a major health problem in the United States and around the world.
Even though we've been aware of this for so long and all of the problems associated with it and the importance of screening, but clearly it's still a major problem.
That's true. And the more we can screen people, the more we can reduce the problem.
So why is early detection so important here, therefore screening so important?
Well, like many cancers, like most cancers, all cancers, if you screen for an illness, you find it at an earlier stage before it's done things like spread to other parts of your body or begun to grow into adjacent tissue and cause systemic problems. Once a tumor begins to change, it can also become more aggressive and spread more rapidly than if it's found earlier. So finding something at an earlier grade and stage is important to being able to beat the illness ultimately.
And particularly, I would think, in the colon where, you know, polyps occur often that are non-malignant, you know, pretty regularly in people. And it's important, I guess, to determine which of those polyps then might go on to become a cancerous one. So I can see why, therefore, the screening is so much more important. There are currently recommendations in place for the American Cancer Society. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Sure. The American Cancer Society recommends that men and women between the ages of 50 and 75 who don't have any symptoms should still be screened for colon cancer.
And that's a full colonoscopy, right?
Well, there are a couple of different options. The American Cancer Society recommends a full colonoscopy every 10 years. And the other options include a flexible sigmoidoscopy, a double contrast barium enema, or a CT scan-assisted virtual colonoscopy every 5 years.
That's a new recommendation, or at least it's a new procedure from my understanding. We didn't have that option at one point.
Yeah, it's been more common in the past few years. These, again, are for people who have no symptoms, no precancerous conditions, no familial risk. So the real message is that everybody between 50 and 75, regardless of risk, should have some level of screening, at least a colonoscopy every 10 years or one of these other methods every 5.
And how about people who have a higher risk? How does that change the recommendations?
Well, people who are at higher risk for colon cancer include people who have previously been diagnosed with polyps of various sorts, as well as people with precancerous or cancer risk-increasing illnesses such as ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, collectively known as inflammatory bowel disease. These illnesses increase people's risk for cancer and as much as a family history. So if a person has first-degree relatives with colon cancer, these people should be more vigilant. Now, the individual person might have a variety of different risk factors, and that's something people should really proactively talk to their primary care physician about what screening regimen is right for them.
So the bottom line is really that every individual really should talk to their doctor and figure out.
Every individual should talk to their doctor because it's something that everybody should be doing.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Christopher Morley, and we're talking about the importance of colorectal cancer screening and a new prevention initiative. So I understand that you are engaged in your department in a new initiative to help promote screening. Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, the title of the project is a bit of a mouthful. It's called the Increasing Cancer Screening Through Academic Detailing and Practice Facilitation Project.
That is a mouthful.
That is a mouthful. So,
what does it mean?
So academic detailing is basically when people from academic institutions go out to practices and bring information to practices in the field. And the word detailing comes from essentially the pharmaceutical industry, when what we would commonly call drug reps would go to doctor's offices and bring samples and bring the physician up to speed about different drugs or treatments. That was called detailing. It was a pharmaceutical industry term. Academic detailing essentially refers to a similar practice when we as academics do it without a profit motive, ideally.
So the mission here is what? Tell us.
So the other aspect is called practice facilitation, which is where you help a practice do something. I'll leave it very general without getting into too many specifics about that. But what we intend to do is to have an outreach program where we send physicians to practices in our community, and by community I mean essentially the entire region from Syracuse to Buffalo, and bring information about guidelines, about different ways to bring patients to screening, to be proactive, and to different sources for public screening programs, such as health department programs or other places that have been identified by New York State as providing low-cost or free screening services.
So basically you're there to get the word out, is what I'm hearing.
That's part of it. And the other part is that we would like to assist practices in developing what are called patient registries, specifically for colorectal cancer screening. And what that would allow practices to do is to be proactive about identifying patients who are outside of screening recommendations and reach out to them. Because typically what you see is in a primary care visit, the person will be there, and if they happen to be having a visit, whether it's an annual physical checkup or some other reason, it might come up in conversation. Having a registry would allow the physician and their staff to reach out and actively identify people who have not been screened. And there's a variety of strategies, from letter writing, phone calls from a case manager, to then make recommendations, bring the people into the office for a physical and recommend screening, so forth.
So basically, this is very proactive. What you're saying is, in many cases, you rely on the patient to come in for their annual physical and what have you, and it's up to the physician to see that as an important, the colonoscopy is an important part of their overall health care. But you're saying you're going to go out there and try to encourage these practices to develop a way of flagging these people and bringing them in more actively.
I'd even say it's a way of screening your population. Screening your population to identify people who need individual screening for colorectal cancer.
Is it necessary in this case, when you talk about a registry, is it necessary for these practices to be electronic in order for it to work most effectively, or can they still be, I know some practices remain paper chart.
Sure. Paper-based registries or registries developed from paper records have existed for a long time. They predate electronic health record
systems.
Specifically, actually, with not screening, but with actual cancer or tumor registries have existed for decades. And those are things that would have been kept in an Excel spreadsheet or an Access database. And practices could certainly do that. It's a lot more labor-intensive. For the size and scope of this project, we are looking to first partner with practices that have electronic health record systems in place.
Built into those would be the opportunity then to identify and flag patients. Is that the idea?
Exactly. Many, I would hazard to say most electronic health record systems have some innate ability or built-in ability to have a registry turned on. And we use them for different things. We use them to identify people who have been vaccinated. We use them for specific disease categories like diabetes or hypertension. So registries have been around for a while. That's not new. Activating them for the purpose of increasing screening rates is, I don't want to say novel, but it's not prevalent in our area.
Is there a particular population that you're focused on? Because it seems to me one would think that most primary care physicians would be well aware that patients need to have these kinds of, routine exams.
Absolutely. Our primary care docs in this region are great. They are certainly up to speed, and hopefully this will just be a refresher when we do the detailing portion, in addition to making some resources available. One of the things we want to do is identify state resources or state-identified facilities that have that offer low-cost or free screening. And the linking people up with those resources is really important, because across health research, you see disparities that happen because of socioeconomics, because people who have limited access to health care or poorer insurance or have lower health literacy, they don't do things as frequently as people who are very actively engaged in their own healthcare, simply because they can be. So we are targeting practices more specifically that are serving underserved populations, Medicaid populations, like community health centers, or simply practices that have a high Medicaid load. That doesn't exclude other practices, but we are focusing on practices that help underserved populations.
That makes a lot of sense. Who's funding this? I mean, where is the money coming from, and where is the initiative really being?
Sure. Well, the New York State Department of Health issued a grant opportunity for us to apply, and we were selected from the entire state. And they're using money that came from the CDC originally, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And we're working within our own practice-based research network, which we call SALTNET, within the Department of Family Medicine at Upstate, which is a loose network of primary care physicians around Syracuse, and we actually stretch up into the Adirondacks and down to the Pennsylvania border. And we're working with partners at the University of Rochester Medical Center and at the University of Buffalo with practice-based research networks that operate in those areas. We've also partnered with our Upstate cancer center that's growing, and Dr. Leslie Coleman has been involved. We are partnered with a consultant from Roswell Park Cancer Institute, Dr. Martin Mahoney, and we're also partnering with area health education centers around the Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse areas to help reach out and get the message.
What do you exactly, I mean, I understand what you hope to accomplish is to get more people into screening. Do you have any baseline stats or numbers? I mean, is this a study in any way, or is it just more of an initiative to just, in a general sense, kind of increase the amount of screening going on?
As a researcher myself, I would not classify this as research. This is really a public health initiative that we're trying to engage our practices with for the good of the public.
So any increase in screening would be a win-win, so to speak.
Absolutely. And we also want to see if these modalities of reaching out to physicians this way and helping them turn on the registries has any effect, and how much effort it takes and how much it costs, to see if we can do more. We may expand into breast and cervical cancer over the next year if this turns out well.
So if this modality, way of reaching doctors, way of reaching patients, works, it really has a lot of potential ramifications.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. I hope maybe you'll come back and tell us more about it down the road. It sounds like a very, very important and interesting initiative. My guest has been Dr. Christopher Morley, Associate Professor of Family Medicine, Public Health, and Psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. Thanks so much for coming in. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hello, this is Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse. We receive many submissions from caregivers, those people who are intimately involved with all the details and duties that often accompany serious illness. This week, we hear from a wife who is handling not only the paperwork and the scheduling, but also her husband's desire not to know and not to talk about the cancer that seems to be fatal. Her gift to him is her silence and her constant presence. Here is Oregon poet Judith Montgomery's poem, Anything. Anything. Because he is not ready, because he does not want to know, I fold and count and stack and lock away the facts. 3 manila folders splay, bad hand across my lap. I ready for oncology, cram reams of research he cannot bear to hear. Prognosis, metastasis, liposarcoma. I become curator of white papers, latched basket of lingo, survival, percentage, cooped up in my throat because my husband, who will lose his spleen, a slice of pancreas, half his diaphragm to the shining, splendid edge of a scalpel, cannot bring himself to ask. Housekeeper of cancer, I tend its difficult laundry. How many months he has, we have, I make of my ribs a wall of whitewashed shelves, fold and stash each terrible fact neatly as his handkerchiefs and socks in the drawer. When we enter the clinic, I hold the door. I will not ask anything where he will have to hear 1 year, two, none.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore bariatric weight loss surgery from the patient perspective, how to make sense of hospital ratings, and what to do if you have chest pain. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. And if you want to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.